Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, welcome to the Driven Celebrities Podcast. I'm Andy J. Now, what a lineup we have for you this week. I am so chuffed with it. We have, well, absolute acting royalty Nigel Havers. Love him. Legend. We have from Boyzone, Shane Lynch, who's actually here to also help advertise our other podcast, which is called the Driven Chat Podcast, which was an automotive skewing podcast and mostly for petrol heads. We have Olympic legend Ewan Thomas, top man, and is so honest and open with me. It's such an engrossing chat. And then our big guest, our long guest for this week, is the incredible David Baddiel, because he and I had such a lengthy and fascinating conversation that we couldn't include it all on the radio show because we simply don't have time. So that's one of the reasons why I have this podcast, so that we can give you more from our guests. And so David Baddiel, we have a feature-length conversation with him. If you'd like to subscribe to the pod, we'd really appreciate it. If you could give us a nice review, tell your friends, and just share it if you're enjoying it, we'd really appreciate it. And if this is your first experience of the Driven Celebrities pod, why not check out our back catalogue, because we have some massive names waiting for you to listen to. Anyway, thank you for your company. Do enjoy the show.
Driven with Andy J on Talk Radio, in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
My first guest is the star of blockbusters like Chariots of Fire, Empire of the Sun, and A Passage to India. He's also a hugely successful TV presenter, has his own touring theatre company, and he's sporting some of the greatest hair in the business. I'm delighted to welcome the one and only Nigel Havers. Nigel, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Talking of hair, it's gone out of control, that man. I haven't had a cut for so long. I look like some bad person that would scare the kids away.
You've had some pretty big hair in several TV shows. You've had some pretty impressive big hair. I mean, is it bigger than what you used to?
I've had some very impressive hair over the years. And then I went for a much shorter cut recently. What I was filming when we were cut down was a show called Finding Alice. And I had very short hair. But that's a long time ago now. So it's gone a bit... Father Christmas, you know?
Nigel, you've done so much. I keep looking at your career and I'm just sort of thinking, is there anything you haven't done? You've achieved so much in your career.
I haven't played Hamlet.
Right.
I haven't played Hamlet. And once I was so keen to play Hamlet that I learned it as a sort of exercise. And I never got it. And then they never asked me. They picked somebody else, I think. And I've forgotten it now. And I think it's a bit late to play Hamlet. Apart from that, I once wanted to do, the BBC many, many years ago were going to film a very favourite book of mine called Fair Stood the Wind for France, an H.E. Bates book. And I was desperate to play the sort of leading part of a pilot in it. And so I went up to audition for it and I thought, well, you know, I've got this in the bag. I'm so perfect for it. And I didn't get it. And I was really mortified because I thought I was perfect. And from then on, I never, ever thought, I never looked forward to, you know, I never say, that's what I want to play, that's what I do. I just became a letterbox actor, which means that you wait for the script to come through the letterbox, and then you do it.
You're not at the point where you have to audition for anything, Nigel, surely. Come on.
No, I don't do that, no. I made up my mind then that I would never sort of hanker after a part. I just wait for the part to come.
That makes sense.
Less disappointment that way, I thought.
You know. Well, look, just quickly tracking back to Hamlet, right? You're saying it's too late now. Why? I mean, you're saying that age is an issue here? I don't see that.
I think it might be. I don't know whether Hamlet, how old would my mother be?
Well,
mind you, my mother's very much alive and well, and she's 91. So, I mean, that's possible.
Well, there you go.
But there you go. It is nothing's impossible. In fact, I'm hoping, with all fingers crossed, at the end of the year, I'm doing Private Lives by Noel Coward.
Yes.
With Patricia Hodge. And we're playing, you know, the couple. We're not too old. I mean, what we devised in the way we're going to interpret it is that we were both divorced, married to much younger people. That didn't work out, so we get back together. That's how we're playing it.
You see, where there's a will, there's a way. And this is with your
Absolutely.
Own theatre company, Nigel, isn't it?
Indeed. Indeed it is. David Pugh, the producer, came to me and said, wouldn't it be a good idea to set up your own theatre company? And my ego was obviously so big, I said, yes, what a fantastic idea. We're going to do 3 plays over 3 years, and that's the first one. So, fantastic.
Nigel, I have to ask you, because, I mean, I have been a huge fan of yours for such a long, 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 long time. I've admired pretty much everything you've done. I've seen all your films. So I've been watching you on television forever. I'm also incredibly envious of your just natural charm and charisma as a presenter, which doesn't seem fair, because some of us have to pay to do that, and it never quite works out. What is it that gets you up in the morning? What excites you? What do you think, when you jump out of bed, which I imagine you do, what is it that you
think,
I'm thrilled to be doing this today?
Well, you know, I'm thrilled to be doing anything. I've always, I go under the principle that another day, another dollar, another day, another wonderful thing could happen. I have to say, the people I meet and bump into are always very charming. I just think most people are absolutely wonderful. So on that theory, one can go out and just enjoy oneself. That's what I think.
And when you say people you meet, do you mean as in members of the public coming up going,
yes,
it's Nigel Havers, hello?
Yes, no, they're always absolutely charming, utterly charming.
It seems to me that it's pretty great to be Nigel Havers. There must be some days where you're in a bad mood, or it's not quite as sunny as it should be.
Well, you know, I just didn't last very long. Just think of the moment, be in the moment. That's the best thing, I think.
Do you know, this has become a life lessons thing. We could make this a feature, Life Lessons with Nigel Havers.
Could. Yes, you could. If we could do it every week, a little one tip, you know. As Bob Monkhouse said once, he said, when I was a child, I said, I want to be a comedian. And everybody laughed at me. But they're not laughing now.
I love it. That's perfect. Nigel, I've been delving into your life a little bit. I hope you don't mind. But because you've had such a fascinating journey through life. You know, starting back in the early days where you convinced your parents, I think it was your brother that went to Eton, and you said, you know what, I'm not up for Eton, which is, you know, quite a bold move. I want to go to theatre school. And you got the you got the nod of agreement from that.
Yep.
I know the timeline is slightly skewed, but you then spent a fair bit of time, how do I say this delicately, putting a few drinks away with the Rolling Stones. Would that be fair?
Oh, yes, that was fun.
Yeah.
I was a bit young to put a few drinks away, but I was certainly got to know them, which was great. When I said I didn't want to go to Eton, I'd already done a bit of research on the theatre schools, and I worked out they were about a third of the price of being sent to Eton. So I went to my dad with the mathematics about going to a theatre school, and he thought, oh, that's interesting. That sort of might have helped a bit.
What I love about that, Nigel, is that you proved to your father you were already smart enough.
Yeah. No, that's right. I did. I did all the research. I found the school I wanted, and I sort of already been and rung them up and said, is it possible to come and audition? And so when he said, actually, you can do that. I said, well, that's great. Tomorrow I'm auditioning for them. And that was perfect. Really? And I got in. So that was fantastic. Really fantastic.
And let's talk about roles, because, you know, let's not beat around the bush here, Nigel. You know, we're both men of a certain age. You're a handsome man. You know,
I don't know about that.
No, you do. You've always been a handsome man. You're charming. You're charismatic. You're athletic. I mean, I feel like I'm, you know, trying to romance you myself at this stage. But that has clearly, I mean, it must have opened some doors for casting agents and directors. Kind of, we've got to see the handsome one. The fact that you have the talent is that, oh, brilliant. He also happens to be an incredibly good actor that can cry on cue and move us to tears. But the handsome thing has helped, hasn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, one doesn't think of oneself like that. So, as I said, I just used to take pretty much anything that came through the letterbox. And I think that looking back, was a wise decision. Some mates of mine were very picky about the jobs they did, and I thought, that's a mistake, you know. You should just pretty much be lucky to be offered anything. So that was my principle, and I've always sort of stuck with it. And when I made a film years ago with Michael Caine, I played his son in the movie, he said to me, I always take any job that comes. And I went, so do I, actually. And so that's why I'm here.
Nigel, when you look back across your career, what is it that stands out to you? What's the moment when you thought to yourself, I have made it now. This is it. I'm here. I'm set.
Well, when we all went up, we all wanted to be in Chariots of Fire, you know, and every actor I knew wanted to be in it. So we all went up and we all auditioned and we ran around fields and we were tested and I got the gig. And then we trained for, I think, 4 or 5 months. You know, I had to be a hurdler in it, so that was kind of something I avoided. I avoided that at school. It looked so uncomfortable, but we trained for nearly 5 months. The film was then cancelled 2 weeks before we were supposed to start shooting. And then the next morning it was put back on again, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, I could tell while we were making it, this was going to be something special. I don't know why, I just felt it was just sort of blessed.
Yeah.
Every time, pouring with rain, and we had to come up and do a scene, the sun suddenly came out. Everything was as if Eric Little and Harold Abrams were smiling and helping us. And it ended up with me sitting in Los Angeles at the Academy Awards with David Putnam saying to us, "We won't win anything, don't worry, just enjoy yourselves." And we did. We won all these things. It was
you
just
certainly did. You so cleaned up.
That night was just amazing. You know, I just couldn't believe it. And the best film goes to Chariots of Fire. We couldn't believe it.
Wow. You must still watch Chariots of Fire, though. You must still put it on from time to time.
I do. If I reach on, I'll have a look. It's just, but you know, it was Hugh Hudson, the director, is still a dear, dear, dear close friend. I spoke to him this morning. Because Ian Holm, as you probably know, died. He was in the film and a very close friend of mine. So we spoke again today. But, I mean, it was a fantastic experience. It was a wonderful film. And, you know, one of those films that everyone remembers. And, you know, there it was. And it cost practically nothing to make. We hardly got paid anything to be in it. But it was just such a fantastic job to have. So that was my sort of highlight, I suppose.
Oh,
anyway.
It's lovely to hear you reliving it, actually. I mean, every time I kind of picture you running on that beach with the music. And I mean, like everybody thinks of you running with the music. And it's just iconic.
Yeah, Vangelis had written some music. So he played it while we were on the beach.
Wow, that is amazing. Remarkable. So what, he was just there kind of bashing it out and you're charging along?
I just think that choosing Vangelis was such a fantastically clever thing to do. Really clever. And in many ways made the film so brilliant.
Well, as a team effort, Nigel, you were pretty strong in it yourself, let's be fair.
Well, we all became great friends. You know, the fact that we were training for such a long time before we actually started shooting, we all became very close friends. So it really shows in the film that we knew each other. And I've always wanted, you know, the idea of being together for months before you actually start shooting is really useful for a movie, really clever. So making the film was really easy. It was like we were just friends, you know? We were like what we were supposed to be.
My thanks to Nigel Havers. What a treat. Now, I'd like to tell you about a podcast that we produce every single week for the petrol head out there. If you love all things automotive and you like your stars, then I reckon this pod is for you. It's called Driven Chat. And each week we're joined by a famous face who just loves four wheels. We've had people like Mike Brewer on the show, Charlie Borman, David Gandy. And this week we have Boyzone's Shane Lynch. Now, you can find the podcast wherever you get your pods, be that Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, Acast, wherever you get your pods, just search for Driven Chat. Now, Shane Lynch started this week by speaking about whether he loved racing more or making music. Here's a clip.
Music definitely never got in the way of racing. It gave me the opportunity to race, without a doubt. I think, okay, I might have done a little bit of grassroots stuff, if anything. I don't think I ever would have had the money to go on and do any more. I think my, especially hot rod stuff, I think you're kind of pigeonholed to the oval, but to get onto an actual circuit or a racetrack takes a lot more money. And back then, I don't know my opportunities. But music, being in Boyzone into the late 90s, without a shadow of a doubt, gave me my world of motorsport. And that was, and basically out of guest drives, to be honest, guest drives. I think my first one, me and Ron Keaton did in Ireland, my very first race ever was in Ireland. We were racing Fiat Unos. I don't even remember having a race license, if I'm honest, back then. And I think we were just a loud race. I don't know, but that's Ireland for
you.
Well,
that's basically because you're in Boyzone, you don't need a race license.
Something like that. And I think I think Ro beat me that day, actually. So that's what I mean. He's definitely a clear second in Mad Into Cars. I had an off. You know, he's a good driver. I've got to say he's a good driver. Maybe I've got a bit more rehearsal time under my belt.
Racecraft.
Yes, I'll call it rehearsal time. You know what I mean? Because that's all it is. Every time you get in a car, you're just rehearsing for the next race. You know what I mean?
What I love about this, though, Shane, is that, you know, we'll obviously talk about drifting because it's something that you went on to be like really good at. But it's not just, you know, we've touched on hot rods. But if memory serves, and my memory's shaky, so I've got to apologise.
Mine too right now.
But you, if I remember, I think it was something like 2003, you were really close to winning British GT, weren't you?
I kind of came up through the ranks of, I tried Rally Enforced. Let me go back a little bit before I get to the actual, what I would say, my glory point in motorsport before I went into drifting. I started in rally cars, and but my gift chance was purely by being a celebrity, of getting into motorsport, period. And I was asked to drive in a celebrity race in the Autosport show.
Nice.
Back in 1998, maybe. Cool. Maybe okay. About 98. So it's quite some time ago. And I was like, yeah, cool. Love it. Sounds great. Mad about cars. Let's go to the Autosport show. Turned up expecting TV personalities, other boy band members or whatever the case may be. But that wasn't the case. There was John Cleland. There was Alan McNeish. There was Alistair McRae.
Well, these are peddlers.
Oh, no, these are pure boys. Yeah. You know, we have touring car drivers, Le Mans drivers, rally drivers. You've got the boys. You've got the big boys, and then this guy called Shane Lynch from a boy band, right? So I was kind of there going,
That's not a celebrity race. That's a bunch of retired racers and you.
Well, yeah, and don't forget, this is back in the day. They were all still in their sports.
Oh, man.
This is 1998. Yeah. You know what I mean? Just 22 years ago. So them boys were driving.
Racing drivers and a dude from Boys Zone.
Correct. So I was like, all right, cool. So a bit of my car history and just my rear-wheel drive skills. We were racing Caterham 7s. And my 86 world, as in Toyota Corolla, twin cams, that's kind of my rear-wheel drive world. Very used to kind of sideways action. So I was like, yeah, cool, man, Caterham 7, no problem.
Brilliant.
So what I did was, the clerk of the course, let's call him at the time, he kind of said, right, boys, it's just for fun. It is just a show. And, you know, it's not serious, the Autosport show. Audience comes in, they all watch you participate in this race. They said, keep it clean, keep it easy to the drivers. And I said, well, okay, Shane, what we're going to do with you is we're going to put you at the back. So you're going to get in the boys' ways, but just go and have fun. I was like, yeah, cool, no problem. I ain't got no problems with that.
And to hear what happened in that race, well, you'll need to download the Driven Chat podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, after the break, very excited for this. I'm going to be joined by David Baddiel.
Driven with Andy J.
It's Driven here on Talk Radio, the show that talks to celebrities and achievers about what drives them. And now I'm so pleased to welcome a comedian, an author, a presenter, a screenwriter, a man who, in fact, I very rarely get to tell my mum who I'm going to be interviewing ahead of time. But when I mentioned who this was, her reaction was, oh, wow, he's a clever old thing. And he certainly is. It's Mr. David Baddiel. How are you doing, David?
Hello, Andy. I'm so pleased about your mother's reaction. I can't tell you.
I mean, it's important, actually, to have this relationship with a random interviewer's mother, isn't it? You know, she says you're a clever old thing. That clearly means a lot.
Yeah, I mean, can I ask how old your mum is? Is that okay?
Yeah. She's just about to turn 70.
She's about to turn 70, yeah. So I'm probably in between her and you in my age. Yeah, I'm 56.
Yeah.
So what I'm trying to work out is, you know, which of the two of you, as it were, grew up with me. I mean, obviously your mum didn't grow up with me because she's older than me, but you know, she was probably, because I've been around a long time, watching me, you know, God, it's possible that she was watching me in her early 40s.
Yeah.
So I've been, you know, that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that that your mum has possibly been a fan for a while.
That's why
I'm processing that.
She has. Well, in actual fact, my mum, if I remember rightly, she dropped myself and my mate Pats off to, was it Wembley Arena, to see you and Ron?
Oh.
So, yeah.
Dropped you off, so you came to Wembley Arena?
We did.
So you would have been, a teenager?
Yeah, exactly. Then. Exactly that. Yeah. When you guys were rock and roll stars, obviously, taking on the arenas with comedy, first time it'd ever been done. I was there.
I was there as well.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. No. I'm glad you were there. It was quite a night. I mean, I'll be honest with you. That particular night was so kind of like big and wild and crazy that I don't have that much memory of it as a gig. I can remember other gigs, both in my own stand-up career and with Newman and Baddiel and whatever, you know, fairly clearly some of them. But that one, it was just a big event. You know what I mean? And it sort of blew out my sense of it as a standard stand-up gig.
Yeah. I mean, it was brilliant. I mean, it was just the experience itself was super cool. I mean, you know, like you, it's going back a fair chunk of time in my memory as well. But I remember being awestruck and just thinking how really very cool the whole thing was. And
yeah, it's 1993, I think. Christmas 1993. It was the last gig that me and Rob ever did together. It was cool. It was cool. But as I say, I mean, because people sometimes say to me, oh, you started the whole trend for arena comedy, and it was the first one, but actually there weren't that many immediately after it. I think arena comedy then didn't really happen for another 10 years or so until YouTube started, and then, you know, some comedians started to get really big because of the internet, and they were able to play arenas. But I don't remember anyone playing an arena sort of immediately after Newman & Baddiel.
No, that's true. That's a very good point. Yeah. Well.
But I'm very happy you're there, and I hope you and your mate got home all right when your mum picked you up.
Yeah, we did. We did. It was absolutely sound. It was a cracking night. I really enjoyed it. And the lovely thing is, David, that I can actually bring this full circle within the family now for you. So you've heard what my mum thinks, okay? But the new audience is my eldest, my 7-year-old son. And I said to him, hey, guess who daddy's going to interview just now? And he was like, who? I was like, the guy that's writing the book we're reading at the moment. Well, written it, obviously. And his reaction, oh, cool. Can you ask him if there's going to be another one? So, you know, it's come full circle.
So you are basically entertained your entire family across 3 generations, is what you're saying.
I hope you're feeling the pressure because, you know.
No, I'm pleased about it. I'm pleased that I've kept you all going. Well, that's lovely. I'm really glad your son is a fan. What book were you reading?
So, well, the new one, Future Friend, which is...
Oh, you were reading Future Friend? Oh, I thought you might be reading one of the older ones.
Now, I was very fortunate to be able to get my hands on a copy of the book a few days ago. And so we are 4 nights of reading into it. Now, you tell me if this is good going or not, David. So I've literally got the book in front of me now, and I'm just flicking through where the bookmark is. So we're on page 255. So that's how quickly we're consuming this book. You know, he is...
Oh, that is good.
He is loving it. I'm literally, I finish a chapter, because your chapters are quite short. I finish a chapter and think, I can clearly see that's a chapter. He's going to let daddy go now. Oh, come on. Just,
how does
just
it work?
More,
can I ask you? Because my children were... Well, actually, they weren't too old. My son wasn't too old, but I didn't really... I read them the books, but only as I was kind of writing them.
Okay.
Because I wanted their thoughts, right? So what I've never done is sit with the book and the illustrations and sort of read it to them. Do you read a bit and then show them the pictures, or how does it work?
Well, it's a bit simultaneous because it also depends on his level of alertness, of course. You know, because we're reading in bed before he falls asleep. So
right. Well, I'm going to take it badly if he falls asleep too quickly.
This is the thing. He's never fallen asleep. I mean, in the 4 nights we've been reading it, but he has told me he's had dreams that have been influenced by the story, which is lovely.
It's particularly lovely because the first chapter, because it's set in 3020, I should perhaps say this for anyone listening, tell them what the book's about. It's about a girl from 3020 who gets into a time machine accidentally and gets transported back to our time, although for reasons that we perhaps talk about in a minute, it's not exactly our time, it's 2019.
Yes.
But in the first chapter of The World of 3020, she is in her bed pod and has set her dream to be scoring the winning goal in the World League final because she loves football. And kids, apparently, that I've spoken to already tell me they love the idea of being able to set your dreams, a machine that sets dreams.
Yes, absolutely right. And my eldest absolutely loves the idea of the parrot having a tiny bed as well, incidentally.
Yeah.
He thinks that's brilliant because, you know, again, if the listener hasn't read the book yet, there's gadgets, talking animals, robot clones, and I'm not giving any of the storyline away. That's for you to do should you so wish or not. But yeah, what I can say is, so my son loves drawing. He's a very passionate artist, so he does consume the pictures as well, but he sees a lot in his head as well, obviously, because you've written it so, I mean, you know this, you've been writing forever. You write it so eloquently and you paint the pictures already, so with your words. So yes, he does look at the pictures, of course, but his imagination is right there as well.
How many children do you have?
Two with another one on the way.
All right, so have you got an older child or a younger child?
My eldest is the one I'm reading it to at the moment. He's 7.
Okay, right. So 7, because my books, I get asked a lot on Twitter or in conversation about my children's books, what age are they for? And I always say, well, kind of any age, really. I mean, including adults, because there's lots of things in the book that I think adults respond to as well if they're reading them to their children.
Absolutely.
And I also think younger children, like a 4-year-old or the parents of a 4-year-old told me that they were reading the book, one of my books, to them recently. And I thought, well, that's quite young, but I don't see why you can't, in the process of storytelling, you know, they won't get everything, but they'll still enjoy the process, I would have thought. But 7 is kind of great, because the sweet spot, I guess, is between 7 and 13.
Yes, yes. Well, it's, I mean, this was a really, because I wasn't sure. I mean, I kind of checked the internet, and I was kind of, people were kind of coming back with 9 years old, and I thought, well, do you know what? I've read my boy Harry Potter, and he's done all right with that, so I'm going to dive in. And he was just engrossed from the beginning. And what I'm really pleased to say, and I'm sure that this was intentional on your part, is he's also started asking the questions, almost sort of in the same sort of Attenborough-esque way, where you're making things clear about what we're doing to the planet and the food we eat, etc., you know, animals and so on and so forth, about how the future perspective is, that's not a good thing, you know? And I'm loving that, you know, we had a conversation over breakfast this morning where he was like, so Daddy, you know, the whole animal thing, I don't think I want to do that anymore. And I was really, really pleased. And I'm sure that that is in part down to the way you've worded it in the book. You're not forcing anything or anything. You're just making some very clear points, which I think are great.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, okay, I'm not going to give any spoilers away, but just so 3020 in the book is a dystopia. It's a not nightmarish, but, you know, climate change. And as it happens, and this is why I had to change it back to 2019, viruses, mutant viruses, make it impossible for anyone to go out. So everyone just lives in tall towers in 3020. And well, I wrote this in January, by the way. And when Pip comes back to our world, and I was writing in February by now, I thought this is no good because I wanted her to come back and be able to go out and have fun and feel healthy and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, oh, no, that's no good. So I had to put it back to 2019. So it's now 1,001 years into the future. So the world is portrayed in 3020, although it's got loads of gadgets and animals have evolved to speak and it's kind of fun, it's also quite dangerous and there's a lot of jeopardy. And so part of the process, without giving too much away, is that when she comes back and she meets Raoul, who's an inventor, he's a child inventor. He actually was a major character in my previous book, The Taylor Turbo Chaser, where he supercharged his best friend's electric wheelchair to become a kind of chitty chitty bang bang style supercar. She's now gone off in the car to Scotland and he's slightly lonely. And so she appears in his dad's warehouse, this girl from the future. And then part of the process is whether or not they can get her back to the future where she needs to get back to. And in so doing, kind of save the world. But I'm not going to give any clues as to whether or not they managed to do that.
Brilliant. Well, given that I've got a few pages to go now, I've got so many questions that I can't ask because it'll spoil it for me. Because in the same way that I'm loving reading to my son, it's a new story to me as well. And like you said, with adults, I'm really enjoying it. It's really lovely. And this is your first foray into sort of science fiction, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've written 4 adult novels, 7 children's novels, a film, a play. Oh, well, I wrote a play, actually.
Godstars.
Yeah, God's Dice, which was on at Soho Theatre in September and was about to transfer to the West End when the West End shut down. And that was about physics, and was about religion and physics. And it was sort of about a girl, well, a young woman who's a kind of genius and who finds these equations that appear to prove the existence of God and prove the existence of miracles. And it's set in the completely normal, everyday academic universe, but it's got an element of science fiction to it that has, I would say. And I really like science fiction. I've read and watched a lot of science fiction. So I hadn't really thought about doing a kid's book, a sort of genre kid's book before, but there's no reason why not, particularly because obviously Doctor Who is loved by kids and time travel in general is a really good idea for kids because, as you say, it's really fun, but it's also kind of educational. And so, yeah, I just went for it. I also am a big fan of E.T. E.T. is one of my favourite films. And just the structure of E.T., about a creature that comes from another place and becomes friendly with a boy from now, that very, very much influenced this book.
It's very cool. And another little aside about E.T. that you may not know, actually, although I kind of see you as the oracle of many things, so you probably do know this, but I had the privilege of talking to Sir Chris Hoy a couple of days ago, and he cites E.T. as the reason why he got on a bike.
I didn't know that. Maybe the oracle of many things. I don't know. Why did Chris Hoy get on a bike because of E.T.? You'll have to explain a bit more there.
Well, simply because as a kid, he watched E.T. He'd never even knew that you could do that kind of thing on a BMX, and he immediately wanted a BMX.
Oh.
He got the BMX, and six Olympic golds later, and he's then crediting E.T. with it. Well,
okay, yeah. But is the Chris Hoy still thinking, but it never flew? Why did it never fly? I did very well on a bike, but I never flew across the moon. I'm worried he's thinking that now.
That should have
been. I can tell you something about E.T. for me, which is, it was very important for me, which is when I was a teenager, I was quite pretentious. I had a big kind of The Cure hair, and I was quite like, I'm a poet and whatever. And I didn't really go and watch mainstream films. I used to go and watch a lot of art films.
Okay.
And I was a bit annoying, is what I'm saying. And then one day, as a laugh, kind of to sneer at it, probably, I went to see E.T., and I never cried so much in my life. Oh, it was unbelievable. I just unlocked this pretentiousness and made it, oh, I see, that's what actual emotion can be created by storytelling. I still think that the end of E.T. is one of the most moving things that's ever been committed to cinema, when E.T. said, I'll be right here to Elliot. Oh. It's so unbelievably moving.
Absolutely.
And in a way, it's really important for me because I think that made me think, oh, what I want to be is a storyteller.
Yes. Yes, it's such a magical piece of filmmaking. I still can't get through the hospital scene. You know, I still can't get through it.
Yeah, it's very upsetting.
Yeah. Yeah, even just the music. I've got the hairs on my arms standing up as we're speaking now, thinking about it, David. It's ridiculous. A quick one. Can we just go back to God's Dice very quickly? Because you sort of touched on, you know, the kind of quantum physics sort of side of it and its relationship to religion and this girl who finds, you know, finds this kind of example of God, which is amazing. And it's kind of got me thinking about these incredible TV shows and films that have come out recently, like Devs. I don't know if you saw that on BBC Two.
I saw Devs.
Which I thought was remarkable, you know, incredible piece of
television. Yeah, it was great.
You know, an Ex Machina.
Devs was great. I mean, actually, I really, there was no way I wasn't going to watch Devs because I'm obsessed with quantum physics and trying to understand quantum physics. It's something to do with, well, it's to do with two things. One is my dad was a scientist and before he got made redundant and sold dinky toys for the rest of his life. But he was a scientist, and in our house when I was a kid, science was absolute king, and you know, the idea that you would be interested in the arts was kind of like laughable. And I think even though I rejected that with some difficulty because my dad was cross about it, I think it stayed with me a bit, that kind of real understanding of the world comes from science, really. And even though that's a very broad thing to say, I think as I've got older, and the idea of like, okay, I need to try and understand the world. That's like part of my wisdom I'm supposed to have as I grow older. It comes from trying to understand nature in its very basic forms. And that really is what physics is about. And so I was always going to watch Devs because Devs, I think probably Alex Garland has got the same thing, clearly was written by someone who'd read a lot of popular physics books. I really liked it. And God's Dice was sort of in that mold, I think.
It's based on the Einstein quote, God does not play dice with the universe. Is that right?
It is based. That's what the title was based on. Mm. I mean, I don't know how much quantum physics your listeners are into, but it's based on something. Well, I'm going to tell you very briefly, if I can. Basically, quantum physics suggests that everything exists in a cloud of probability. So because you can never tell where any particle is, basically everything that we see is just likely to be there, but may not be there, maybe somewhere else or whatever. And therefore, really extraordinary stuff might be true. It might be true that in some infinitesimal probability, the Red Sea split in half, water turned into wine. You can provide an equation, which happens in the play, for the probability that water could turn into wine. It's like an infinitesimal possibility based on all the molecules in water and wine behaving really weirdly at one particular moment. And so this girl uses this idea to sort of create an idea that maybe all the miracles that we base our mythic culture on, our religious culture on, maybe they are true. And yeah, a kind of religious cult grows out of that.
I love it. Wow. Blimey. I mean, you know.
Unfortunately, it's not on. It's not on at the moment because there's no theatre.
Is it? I mean, that's a bigger question, isn't it? Is it looking like it will return when theatres and, I mean, normal is such a rubbish name for what we're going back to if we ever get back there, but you know what I mean. If we get a control of this virus, which again is like a rolling a dice at the moment itself, but should theatres reopen, does it look like it will go to the West End as planned?
Possibly. I mean, as it happens, I got asked to do my troll show. So I was, before lockdown started, doing my stand-up show, which is called Trolls Not the Dolls, which is about online rage and craziness and stuff and my own experiences amongst the kind of darkest and most terrible part of Twitter. And I was doing my show about that when lockdown happened, and just the other day, because NIMAX, the company NIMAX, who run about 5 West End theatres, are rather bravely opening them up and doing shows, and they offered me a week doing Trolls Not the Dolls. And I, in the end, decided not to do it, not because I don't support what they're doing, but I just thought things are going slightly in the wrong way at the moment. And I'm not convinced that people are going to, certainly not my age of audience, which is kind of over 40, and not, I'm not talking about the children's books now, but the people who come to my stand-up shows, they tend to be people who maybe saw me at Wembley, whether they're going to want to come out and watch shows and sit in an audience if the R rating gets worse and worse. Having said that, I'm encouraged by the fact that stuff is happening, people are trying to put stuff on, plays are scheduled and all the rest of it. And yeah, I mean, I think God's Dice, which had Alan Davis in the main role and was brilliant in it, and I think was keen at that point at least to do it again. If everything could be put together in the same way, then it would happen in the West End. One interesting thing about that is that the first conversations that I had when people said to me, oh, you want to do this play again, maybe when theatre starts again, is they started saying, but how are you going to include the pandemic?
Right.
And then there was this weird thing, which I thought, so everything that's written now, everything that's restaged, everything new, is going to have to somehow include the pandemic. And that's odd, because you think, like, well, it's about religion and physics. It's not really anything to do with a global pandemic. But then not to have it in feels weird, because there are scenes in which people are at parties, and there are scenes in which people are at lectures. You think, like, well, that wouldn't happen. So that was a challenge, which I haven't got down to facing at the moment.
Yeah, that's a tough one to figure out, isn't it? I guess
it's a tough one for all fiction. It's all fiction from now on, apart from period stuff or indeed science fiction. Anything set now, which is when most fiction is set, you know, most novels are just set in whatever time, you know, we're all existing in. Is it always going to have to include that social distancing and masks and, you know, all the rest of it? I mean, maybe it is, but it seems to me a bit weird because, like, I saw something yesterday, right? I saw this program, which is on telly now, called Love Life, with Anna Kendrick in it.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen it.
Not yet.
It's just on BBC now.
Okay.
So it's set in 2010, and there didn't seem to be any reason for it to be set in 2010. And I thought, are they just setting it in 2010 to avoid the virus? Which they might be. I mean, that's what I did with Future Friend. I set it in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, everything's just going to be in 2019, isn't it, for the next 15
years?
Yeah,
we have this weird thing where all drama and all novels are going to stop at 2019.
Yeah, there will literally be nothing set in 2020.
Unless it's about the virus.
Except a pandemic show. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Gosh, I've sort of had a look on your website, because I'd love to come and see you again, and Trolls Not the Dolls sounds like it's going to be hilarious. It does say that you are set to start again at the Watford Coliseum in February 2021. Is that still a big question mark?
Yeah, well, at the moment it is, but I don't know if I'm allowed to mention another radio show, but I did Chris Evans' radio show this morning.
He's part of the family. You're more than welcome.
Yeah, he's part of the family.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I did his Virgin Breakfast show this morning. And I mentioned that, and he said I'd go for September.
Really?
I don't know that Chris Evans is Nostradamus with this stuff, but I take his point. I don't feel in my bones that stand-up tours in general will be back on in February. But I hope so. I mean, apart from anything, one of the things that I think a lot of comedians think about is how material dates, like topically. I mean, some of it's obviously topical, so I have 10 minutes in my show about Trump. Okay. Now, I don't know that Trump will be relevant or as relevant in a year's time as he is now, if he loses the election. But just generally, when one writes comedy, it tends to feel like, okay, this is like what is of now. You know, it's zeitgeisty, it's relevant, even if it's not specifically about politicians from now or whatever. And then suddenly you're doing a show 3 years after you wrote it. It can feel really weird. Yeah. So obviously I'll write new stuff, but I still want to do that show that I was planning to do because that's what people bought tickets for, you know.
Yes, yes, that's a really challenging. You've got some dilemmas ahead, David.
I think we all have, though, Andy, haven't we? It's all, you know, one thing that 2020 has been is challenging. It's created a lot of dilemmas for all of us.
Yes. Yes, it's been, I mean, I've heard it sort of described in so many different ways, as I'm sure have you. And you know, there's this sort of slightly condescending phrase that keeps coming back, which is the great reset button, you know, for humanity. And it just, I don't really see that. I don't know if I'm kind of naive there, but how is it a reset? You know, we're...
Yeah, I don't know if it is a reset. I think, because apart from anything, I think we've been primed by fiction, by science fiction or whatever, to think that if there's a great event like a pandemic, and I've actually read a few books about pandemics, they tend to wipe out humanity, don't they? Or, you know, 90% of humanity, and then it's very apocalyptic and everything has to start again. Whereas, of course, what's happened with this is a kind of fractured, limping, you know, things, you know, it was really impactful, but it's not like the whole of our civilization has changed. Some people seem unaffected by it, you know, and then we're starting our civilization again, but they're not. You know what I mean? It's not like a drama where things tend to be, right, here's the big instigating incident and now everything's different. It's very real life in that it's kind of like shades of grey as to whether or not we've all changed or it's in fact just like it was before, but much more inconvenient.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like it united everybody for about 5 minutes. And then some people chose to behave and do what we were told, and other people decided to completely ignore it. And, you know, everyone just kind of splintered so quickly. You know, people decided to decide for themselves much faster than I think we were anticipating.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what I've heard. I heard it today and I've heard it before. Is there are people, and I guess even I am in a way, who are nostalgic for the early days of what might be considered to be proper lockdown because of that sense that, you know, even though it was harsher in terms of restrictions, there was a sense of community, of everyone being in it together. Mm. The clapping felt incredibly emotional back then.
Yeah.
You know, it felt more like, okay, we are in this drama and we're all together and we're all pulling through together. Whereas now, with local lockdowns being different and, you know, a sense that, like, oh well, I'm not sure we're all experiencing the same thing. It's hard to know how to feel about it.
I blame the eye test.
Dominic's eye test.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I was him, I'd just go to an optician next time. It's really easier.
Yeah.
And they have them in Durham.
Yeah.
No one's pointed that out, actually. Actually, can I just say no one's pointed out? I know a lot of people have pointed out how ridiculous it is to say you had to drive to Barnard Castle from Durham to check your eyesight.
Yeah.
But no one has said, and I've been to Durham, I played it twice on my last tour, and I remember quite clearly there's a Boots and they've got an optician in Durham.
Without
I don't know why you couldn't just go there.
Yeah. Well, in fact, there's probably several in Durham. I'd have thought there'd at least be a Specsavers as well.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I'd say there's four or five in Durham.
Yeah.
There might even be another one on the way to Barnard Castle.
there might be one right by it. I mean, you know, if there isn't a portable optician that has pitched up outside it now, then they're missing a trick, because that would be, you know.
True. Yeah.
David, thank you so much for your company. What a pleasure. What a joy.
No, it was a great pleasure. Thank you so much. Lovely talking to you.
Driven with Andy J.
Hey, welcome back to Driven here on Talk Radio. Andy J here. I am very pleased to be able to be... Well, actually, I'm sat in the kitchen of someone who I am a huge fan of. I'm going to call him Olympic legend, but it's Commonwealth. It's basically, if you think 400 metres, you think Ewan Thomas. How are you doing, Ewan?
You might think Roger Black as well, to be fair.
Now, who?
Yeah, okay, yeah. Who was he?
This is all about what drives you.
Oh, okay.
It's the show that drives celebrities and achievers, and what it is that gets them out of bed in the morning, gets them going. And one of the reasons why I was really keen to talk to you isn't just because of what you've achieved in your former career, athletics, obviously, but it's because you had a career that you knew had a shelf life.
Yeah.
Right? And it's almost about what happens once you've fulfilled dream number one.
Well, I didn't really fulfil dream number one, so that's why I think in many ways it was harder for me, and it's hard for many sportsmen and women who don't have the opportunity to sort of shut the curtain when they want, to sort of go out in a blaze of glory. I had lots of injuries, and if truth be known, I kind of fizzled out, and I kept thinking one more year I'll get back, just keep injury free, and I didn't. So in a weird way, by the age of 24, I think I'd had a medal from every single major championships and then nothing after that. So it kind of... it came to a horrible end, really, where I battled with it for a long, long time. I thought I was okay. But then when I look back now, I went through a good number of years where there was a lot of anger, I think, inside me. The fact that my body let me down, you know, and I only had sort of three or four good years, and then it said, no, I've had enough. And I could only really train 2 or 3 days a week without breaking down, which on the world stage is not good enough. It doesn't matter how naturally talented you might think you are. When you're up against the best in the rest of the world, you've got to be training every day of the week. And unfortunately for me, my athletics career kind of like, yeah, as I said, it ended a lot sooner than it should have.
What did you do when you were feeling the anger?
Bottled it up, which was the worst thing. I didn't ever talk to anyone about it. It was a weird situation where I felt if I was to say, I'm struggling here, I'm a bit frightened about my future, I thought it would be showing a sign of weakness. And I mean this with respect, but all my friends are just really good, regular people. So I've got my mate Gumbo, who works for the local council, my mate Tim, who drives a taxi, my mate Stephen, who's a fireman, all friends of mine who I felt kind of, I'm not saying looked up to me, but were proud of me.
Yeah.
They were proud of their mate who's made a living out of something he loved doing, running around, being as quick as he could be. And I felt if I went to them and said, guys, I'm fed up of being injured. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't think I'm ever going to get back to the level I want to be at. I felt they'd turn around and go, oh, you're all right. You've got a nice house. You know, you've owned lots of nice cars. You know, you do better than we do. Well, you're not getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to cut the grass or, you know, to take someone on a run in a taxi. So I felt kind of like I couldn't talk to them. And now I have spoken to them. They're all really mad at me. Going, why the hell didn't you talk to us? Because, you know, I think the one thing, let's call it depression or anxiety or dark times. I think it doesn't care who you are, it doesn't care how many zeros you've got in your bank. If it's going to get you, it's going to get you. And for whatever reason, we all have different pressures in life, and it's how you deal with those pressures and come back from it. And I think sport, don't get me wrong, sport has been brilliant for me. It's given me the life it has, but it's also been horrible as well. Mm. It's a very lonely place when you're doing any sport, but I should think an individual sport in particular is tough, because when you are injured, when you are sat at home watching it on TV, you're on your own. You're totally on your own, you know, and that's not a nice place to be.
Well, especially as well, you know that at your peak, those people you're watching on telly, you've got them.
Yeah, that's the worst bit. I don't mean this with any disrespect, but I had to go for a number of years. Even now, you could say, I've still got the British record. I've had it 23 years. No one's beaten my time I did back in 1997. So when I had the years of injuries, I was watching people win the British championships in a time a second slower than I could do. And I was literally there, like, kicking myself, thinking, I'm injured, but I reckon I can still beat them. And that was my problem. I rushed back from injuries because I kept thinking, no, I can be half fit and still beat them. Yeah. And I couldn't. But, you know, it's very frustrating when you watch, I should think in any walk of life, when you watch someone doing a job you know you can do better, it's a very, very frustrating place to be.
So you weren't able to talk to your mates. You were getting angry.
Yeah. Well, not so much angry. I think I was just getting disappointed. Not the system, but just life. Because I just thought, why is it all I'm doing is training as hard as I can to be the best that I can be, and my body's breaking? And I know there's people in my sport who have taken things they're not allowed to take, and I'm sure the things I could have taken that would have got me back from injury a lot quicker, but morally I would never have done that, and I never would do anything like that. So there I was thinking, you know, I had 3 or 4 good years, and I know there's probably certain Americans I used to compete against who failed drugs tests, and they had 10 years at the top, and that's what made me more angry. I thought, you know, why me? All I'm trying to do is be the best I can be.
In a perverse way, though, Ewan, you know, retrospectively, at the time I realised, and this is no consolation at the time, just referring to the Americans who took performance-enhancing drugs, that did actually ultimately serve you, didn't it? Because they got caught, and as a result, you got a retrospective gold.
That was weird, though, yeah. So that was the 1997 World Championships. We just missed out in Atlanta, the Olympics a year before, in the 4x4 to America. And in 97, the following year, equally very, very close, photo finish, just lost out. 13 years later, we get told, oh, by the way, you're world champions. 2 of those athletes failed drugs tests later in their career And fair play to them. They put their hands up and said, if we're going to be honest, we were cheating back in 97.
Yeah, that's decent, to be fair.
It was kind of decent in a weird way, but it was a weird one. We didn't get the lap of honour. We didn't get the 13 years of being crowned world champions. Quite frankly, I didn't get the prize money and the bonus money as being a world champion. So we lost out, not just financially, but I suppose morally, and the lovely feeling you get from winning, we'll never replicate that. And I don't mean to be nasty to my governing body, but I got my world championship medal in a car park in Birmingham. We didn't even have a big medal ceremony. We didn't have any of that. It literally was, if you're in Birmingham, swing by, we'll give you your medal. And I was like, yeah, all right. And the big kick in the teeth, when you go to any major championships, the medals are beautiful, yeah? So, for example, the silver medal I got from the World Championships in Athens, they had, like, Greek mythology, and it will have something to represent that country or that city, wherever the games are at. So I thought, do you know what, fair play, the Americans have obviously given their gold medals back, we're going to get the exact same medal in gold.
Yeah.
It wasn't. It was just a plain gold medal engraved World Champions 1997. It was like one of those kiddie ones you get at Christmas that you bite into. I threw it under a bed. I've never looked at it since.
Seriously?
Yeah. And how bad's that? A world champion and I've never looked at the medal since.
I mean, I get it because of the backstory too.
Yeah, the backstory and the fact that the medal is a cheap version of what it should be. It was a bit of a bittersweet, that one. It wasn't the victory it should have been, but hey-ho, that's life.
Fair enough, man.
You
Fair
move
enough.
On.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're 24. You know, yeah. you have
not
achieved.
Now, I'm not. I wish I was.
This was 50 yeah, years yeah. ago.
Oh, easy.
So you're 24.
Yeah.
You have achieved, like you said, you've won medals and, you know, everything. In every different competition in which you were competing,
It happened quick as well for me. I kind of, the year I left university, I got the Olympic silver. Then it was the world silver, which became the gold. And then the following year, 98, I became European champion, Commonwealth champion, and I won the World Cup in the 400 and then relay medals as well. So in the space of sort of 3 or 4 seasons, a lot happened for me. And I think that is, in a weird way, why it hurts so much to get injured. Like that year that I became European champion, I was the first Welshman to ever even make a 400 final, won the Commonwealth Games. I came back and I had a letter from Buckingham Palace about getting an MBE, and I thought it was a joke, so I didn't reply. I thought one of my mates has printed that out. Nice one.
Yeah,
I'm not falling for it. And I totally ignored it. And then another letter came, and I still ignored it. It was the third letter, and they were like, you haven't replied. And I thought, Mum, I phoned my mum. I said, Mum, do you reckon this is real? She goes, it probably is.
Yeah.
So that year I got the MBE, and then maybe even more proud for me, I was in Madame Tussauds as a waxwork.
I was
only at the time the second athlete behind Jesse Owens, I think, to have a waxwork. And it was voted by the public, which made it even more special. But then I felt so guilty because that was 90... I think I went in 99, then got a really bad injury and never really ran that well again. And I think they must have melted me down within 3 years. I don't know.
Actually, I have an update on the waxwork.
No, don't wind me up.
I've looked into it because of this conversation.
They keep the head and they melt the body, do they?
They've had the waxwork the entire time. Unfortunately, due to the heat wave this weekend.
Oh, babe, I thought you've been serious then. So I'd like to buy it. I know that's very vain, but I'd love to have it
on the fridge.
Yeah, I'd love to have it.
Your head up there would look amazing.
Yeah, because they cost a lot to make. Because I remember at the time they said it's like 30 grand to make it. And the weirdest thing is, every time I was going in and they keep doing updates of, like, you know, they measure you like literally everywhere. This is the weirdest thing. They came to my flat at the time and they put all these little green everything. They put these little green stickers on me. And I said, what are you doing down there? And they said, we have to like measure like absolutely all of your body.
And were you like, hang on a sec.
Yeah, give me a minute. and it was the weirdest thing. But when I was being made or sculpted, the Spice Girls were as well. And they were in the studio next door. And every time I went in to see Louis, the guy who was doing mine, I was going, baby Spice in today? Sporty Spice? And I kept missing
them. All right, posh.
Yeah, I kept missing them. But yeah, so at the same time I was being made, the Spice Girls were being made as well. But it was a real honour, if I'm honest. It really was.
No, but it's true, because you were, at that time, it was the kind of Posh and Beck's mania, wasn't it? And you were a headline sharer.
Well, I think the 400 metres was quite a glamorous event back then. I think because domestically, there were 4 or 5 of us who were all running really quick. We really pushed each other on. So obviously, myself, Roger Black, Mark Richardson, Jamie Balsh, Dwayne Ledejo. But there was a good crop of British athletes.
Yeah.
And I think it was a really good time to be a 400-meter runner. And a bad time, because Michael Johnson was around. But apart from him.
I mean, and he would get really measured.
Yeah.
In the waxwork department.
Yeah, he would, definitely.
You couldn't avoid that. So my point was coming to be, really, you know, when the injuries were mounting, when you were kind of the back of your mind, you were like, do you know what? I'm actually not going to be able to do this forever.
Yeah.
at what point did you start thinking about the next steps? Because, you know, and I'm going to be blunt,
yep,
and tell me to back away if you want me to, but, you know, we're sitting in your beautiful house. You know, yep, you've got an absolutely stunning, you know, it's the kind of house that you'd see in a magazine, right? You live in a beautiful house. Some of your toys I'm incredibly jealous of. You've got some Hot Wheels in the garage.
Yeah.
So you've set a standard for living. Do you know what I mean? Athletics obviously provided you a certain level of lifestyle.
Yeah.
Where you don't want to then go and do something that's going to be a step down.
Well, I think I was quite smart, if I'm honest with you. Smart or tight, whatever you want to call it. But my dad has always been really savvy and quite strict with me. So when I was doing well as an athlete, apart from cars, I didn't really waste money. I bought properties straight away. As soon as I could afford a house, I bought a house, kept that, got another house. I kind of was quite sensible, and I wasn't stupid. I knew being an athlete, even before my injuries happened, wouldn't last forever. So I knew this was a career that could be short-lived. But my second career, if you want, doing bits and pieces with TV or whatever, you know, I do, I kind of fell into it. I was always one of those athletes who really enjoyed the interviews at the end of a race. You know, I loved it. I'd a bit of a prankster, a bit of a personality, if you want. I felt I had a personality anyway. And I used to really look forward to, you know, Sally Gunnell, whoever it was, chucking a microphone in my face at the end of a race. I just loved it. And I never felt fazed by it. But I think for me, when I realised, oh, this is all right, I had a documentary done about myself in the late 90s, and I had a camera crew follow me around literally for 2 years. And I wasn't really fazed by a camera. You know, I can totally ignore it if someone's filming us at the moment. It doesn't bother me. So I just enjoyed it. And then towards the end of my career, I had a couple of injuries. And you always get asked to do different TV programs when I was, you know, running well, and you do the odd question of sports or bits and pieces. But obviously my training had to come first. I then ruptured my Achilles and had a long time out. And at the time, ITV approached me and said, look, we were doing this show. And in the end, the show didn't really work out, which was a disappointment. But it was a program called Celebrity Wrestling. And it was like Gladiators, a really big Saturday night show. It was a big show. And I ended up doing that, and I won it. And I just really liked the whole fake bubble of TV, you know, getting looked after. And, you know, and I think really, like, in fact, someone the other day on social media, I can't remember, I think I put up a picture of my motorbike, and they messaged me and they said, you're lucky you are. And I felt like going back. So I'm not lucky. I've worked hard in life. Do you know what I mean? When people say you're lucky, I just think, no, you make your own luck. You know, I worked blooming hard as an athlete, you know, and I've also worked very hard in trying to create another career, you know, so I've done lots of TV shows I wish I hadn't. I've worked on things I thought, well, but you know, I've done my graft, if you want, I think. I've worked quite hard, and once again, I'm not stupid. It's like sport. You'll get out of it what you put in. It doesn't matter how good you might think you're in front of the camera. You've got to work hard, and, you know, doing stuff on the One Show or wherever it might be, like you do. I do my research, I prep, I work as hard as I can. And also, I know this career won't last forever. So, you know, I am looking at other things as well. I've got business interests as well, a few bits and pieces I do away from the weird world of this TV and radio.
You're very good at this weird world, though, isn't it?
It is a weird world.
It is, and it's also transitory. You know, I mean, I've had a 25-year career now, and some years are ridiculous. You know, you don't stop. You don't actually see any friends or family because you're working 8 days a week. You know, it's amazing. And then the phone stops ringing for months, and you're like...
It's like being an athlete. Yeah. It's like being injured. And it's a really... I'd say it's an insecure industry. If you're insecure, this is not the industry to be in, because like you said, you can go absolutely ages where the phone doesn't ring. You think, oh, crikey, I'm not flavour of the month anymore. What's happening? And then all of a sudden, you'll have 3 months where you're flat out. You think, oh, I want a day off. Yeah. You know, but it is how it is. You know, but I think you've just got to be aware of that. And you just got to realise it isn't a regular 9-to-5 where you're going in, you're getting your pay packet every month and you know where you stand. It's quite a strange world to be in, but I quite like it. I quite like the buzz of it.
That's it for this week here on Driven on Talk Radio. If you'd like to hear more from this week's guests, or indeed hear from our massive back catalogue of celebrity conversations, then please do check out the Driven Celebrities podcast. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, and it features all sorts of extra conversations, and we often go long with the guests that you've heard today and throughout the weeks on Talk Radio. It's the Driven Celebrities podcast, wherever you get your pods. Now, on the show next week, we're talking to rugby legend James Haskell, top presenter Jason Bradbury, and Strictly's Anton Dubek.
Driven with Andy J.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.